giving peace a chance. The other night, my wife and I were out with two of our dearest friends, and try to put this next paragraph in context. It's a little bit jarring. And one of our friends was the person that did for many years in the 70s and 80s the long form, very intelligent Playboy interviews. And she was the person who was sent, and here's the jarring paragraph, sent to do the Playboy interview of Mother Teresa. Now, I know that does sound like a Saturday Night Live skit, and that's the way it struck me also. So, you know, I gave her the Dr. Phil, so how'd that work out for you? And she said, well, not so well. She chased Mother, it was arranged, but she chased Mother Teresa from disaster to disaster. And with her own, my friend's New York, I won't call it cynicism, but skepticism, she finally tracks her down, not at all ready for anything to happen, meets her, and just bursts out into tears. She felt like she was in the presence of somebody who was different and special, and the words caught in her throat, holy, that was a problem for her. So she kept chasing Mother Teresa around and meeting her friends, meeting people that she'd taken care of, and one thing that you couldn't do was touch her. She didn't allow herself to be touched. She did not want to be venerated. And my friend just felt she was with somebody very special. And I said, but I don't remember reading the interview. She said, there was no interview. I couldn't put into words, and every question seemed idiotic. So I asked her, so did you at least do the story, which every columnist knows, it's the story about why you can't write the column. Did you do an article on why you couldn't do an article on Mother Teresa? And she said, no, I just couldn't do it. So when I sat down to write about giving peace a chance, with the New York Times on one side, with the LA Times on the other side, with Newsweek in front of me and CNN on, I looked at my wife and said, how in the hell am I going to write something on giving peace a chance? And she looked at me and said, well, why don't you do the column that you suggested to Marcia? Do the sermon on why you couldn't do the sermon. And I said, that's a terrific idea. I can get away with that once every 20 years. And so I started to do the sermon on why I couldn't do the sermon. And I wrote myself, and you for a while, into what felt like a hopeless position. And then, having immersed myself in it, wrote myself, and I hope you, out of that position. So I'm inviting you to take this journey with me today. And as my friend T.S. Eliot said, let us go then, you and I, with the evening spread out against the sky. I don't know how you talk and write about peace and giving peace a chance. We human beings are so inconsistent about peace. We all honor it. It's our highest principle. Every society, left and right, communist, fascist, everybody honors peace, which usually means on their own terms and without any respect for whatever anybody else thinks. But we honor it. We honor it. We hold it up. We worship it. But it's much harder to practice. It's easy to honor, and it's hard to do. We look at our three great Western faiths of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. All of them finding their spiritual center in Jerusalem, which is an ancient, even pre-Hebrew, combination of two words meaning the foundation or the source of peace. Oh boy. Irony meet tragedy. We look at our three great monotheistic religions and we look at their prayers. At the heart of Judaism, grant us peace, thy most precious gift, O thou eternal source of peace. Christianity. Jesus is the Prince of Peace. The word Islam has salam within it, peace. It means literally surrender or submission to the peace that is knowing the presence of God. Jews and Muslims, both when meeting and parting, say, peace be upon you. Shalom aleichem, salam aleikum. But it's so much harder to do than it is simply to honor. It takes me to the question about the Ten Commandments. Honor your father and mother. If it's just with words, it's not honoring. It has to some way find expression in our lives. And lest you think that this is just a Western religious problem, it is distressingly, depressingly true that Hindus kill Hindus and Muslims, that even our somewhat over-idealized Buddhists from time to time kill their brothers and sisters and sometimes complete strangers. There doesn't seem to be a religious exceptionalism. No matter how primitive and fundamentalistic you are or how rational you are, it's not simply the religions. Those are the cover stories. Those are the uniforms. Those are the organizing principles, how we identify the sides in these inhuman human conflicts. Because when we look at non-religious systems, Stalin did a pretty good job in the name of the people, not of God, of killing 20 million people. Mao was no slouch. Pol Pot and Sukarno slaughtered their own and the strangers. The problem isn't the religion. The leitmotif here is humanity. It's in our genes. The insanity, the rage, the making of other, the different becomes the other, and the other becomes the non-human. And we have all of this, used to be adrenaline, but it's been replaced through scientific breakthroughs by epinephrine. We have all of these fight and flight reflexes where when we are angry, when we are frightened, whether individually or corporately, by corporately I mean institutions and cities and nations and religious organizations and religious movements, where we go mad. Literally, we as human beings can go mad and throw away our beliefs, throw away our values, because of that rush, that energy chemical rush that erases the reason that we otherwise hold up and we want to smash. Well, we can't throw away religion. We can't throw away secular institutions. And we can't throw away the genes that we inherited from the primordial soup. We have to deal with the terrifying fact that we're the winners. It was our DNA that survived out of that primordial soup and rose up and became human within Africa, that went across through the Middle East and dispersed across Asia and Europe and across to the Americas, and we're the winners. And the great question for humanity is, can those traits that got us this far get us to the next step, the next century, next week? And it's an open question. How can we evolve? As I sat discussing with my wife, with Newsweek open and the New York Times and the LA Times, I'm looking, and some private intelligence service material that I receive, I'm looking at the world and I'm seeing, I'm getting very reliable information that Iran is planning on attacking Israel in October. and that they are secreting weapons and scuds and suicide bombers and chemical weapons into southern Lebanon. I'm getting equally reliable information that Israel is planning on attacking Iran in October. October is going to be a very interesting month, apparently. And that they're going to use nuclear weapons, but not to worry, they're only theater nuclear weapons. Theater nuclear weapons doesn't mean weapons that were made for the stage. Theater means that they are small and they won't kill too many hundreds of millions of people. So from that, I get very relaxed and happy. I'm getting information about how Al-Qaeda is searching desperately to either get loose nukes from the former Soviet Union or to get them from Khan, who was running a nuclear wholesale shop out of Pakistan and helping Iran and Libya and North Korea. I'm, of course, looking at how what's America going to do and what's Japan going to do and what's South Korea going to do about the apparent fact that North Korea sank a South Korean ship with a torpedo and that North Korea has an unacceptable nuclear program. It's hard not to get a little depressed from time to time if you are watching the news. It's hard not to look at the world as a very serious place and start talking about them. All of those bad people out there, and you know, we better preempt them before they preempt us. And we better get involved. We're not fighting enough wars. We got to get really angry because, well, as Gary said, there are evil people in the world. There is evil in the world. The question is, what do we do? How do we deal with this in a way that isn't completely sentimental and idealistic, or a way that isn't so cynical that we just withdraw from the world and say, no, I don't want to play. Let somebody else do it. It's a hard balance. It's really easy to get mad at them, whoever them might be. Them ought to make peace. Them ought to put down their weapons. Them ought to stop being so angry and frightened. And then I look at them, and that them is sometimes me. And that's really disturbing, because I'd much rather be mad at them. Because if I look at me, then I might actually have to do something about peace out there and peace in here. Because my DNA is part of that winning DNA, and I've got the added disadvantage of being a male. This is not necessarily a good thing if you're looking to make peace, because we carry all of these flight, fight reflexes, and when in danger, when in fear, when enraged, a bunch of stuff happens. That epinephrine flows through the body, releasing testosterone. Testicles retract in order to protect themselves in the course of battle. And the cerebrum passes over control to the cerebellum, the lizard brain, the primitive brain. And it's only an accident, it's not an etymology, that the last word, last part of cerebellum is bellum, which is war. That's not the etymology. This is a separate coincidence, bellum in the Latin. But that's the lizard brain. That's the primitive brain. And what happens when it calls to us? Well, the very same evening that we were talking about the interview and non-article with Mother Teresa, on my way to that, it's rush hour. I turn left onto Olympic, and I'm one lane from the curb lane, and I signal to go to the right because that's where the restaurant is. And my signal, my turn signal indicator, I don't know about yours, but mine is magical, because if I turn it on, it makes other cars automatically speed up. It has some kind of electronic connection, and I don't know how that works. because I turned it on and somebody sped up to block the lane and then honked at me and then communicated digitally. And I don't mean that electronically either. And I will tell you, I wanted to kill him. The impulse struck me to just, how much would it cost? Really, if I just turned the wheel in and smashed him and wiped that snarl and snicker off of his evil face. I mean, I might have to, if I got a jury, no jury would convict me, but I wanted to smash him. I felt road rage. I did not respect the inherent dignity of his miserable personhood. I wanted to smash his miserable personhood, and I knew the impulse felt really good. My heart was racing, my face was red, and my wife looked like she wanted to be in another car. But I backed off. Let him get ahead, then cut off the next person and got into the lane. Let my heart rate come back to normal and then ask myself, this is the same heart that loves my wife, my children, even my daughters-in-law, my grandchildren, my six perfect grandchildren. This is the same brain that holds up peace as the most precious gift. And then I realized we have choices. It isn't the urge, it's following the urge. Whatever the Gospels say and whatever Jimmy Carter said, it is different to commit violence with your hands than it is to fantasize it in your head. He was talking about something else, but it's related. I'll actually explain it. The words in the Ten Commandments for adultery doesn't actually mean what you think it means. It actually means unbridled, uncontrolled passion, which can be sexual or it can be warlike. It actually is not specific to the sex act. Strangely enough, that commandment is under don't covet thy neighbor's ox and ass, but don't go there. I'm not making this stuff up. That's actually true. We have choices not to listen to the call of the wild. We have choices when the epinephrine is flowing and the rage is there not to be so terrified by it that we have to do it, but to understand that we can step back. That's the power of reason. Reason is not with us, controlling us at every moment of our lives. There are all different kinds of temptations that lure us away from our values. And if you look out there in the great political world and the people who keep falling and falling and falling, these are people who are obsessed by values that when their instincts want to overthrow them, it makes the values crumble. My instincts want to overthrow my values all the time. But it's not terrifying because you have choices. The poem that Sophia read is the heart of my sermon. Peace is possible. It's not easy, but it's possible. But it doesn't start with them. It doesn't start with the belief that our institutions, that are us corporately, can be better than we are ourselves. And in fact, when we make our institutions, whether religious or political, the them out there, we distance ourselves from our own power and responsibility. Peace begins with us. It begins by stepping away from the abyss, the madness of following the call of the epinephrine. It begins by saying, okay, I feel it, but I don't have to follow it. It begins where it ends, in responsibility, in trying to have love in our hearts, and then to practice love in our lives. Peace is a one day at a time. For some of us, a one moment at a time kind of process. A couple of years ago, when I was having problems with gout, this was during the period where I was very conventionally religious and only wore sandals because I couldn't put shoes on because of my gout problems, I was given steroids, and they made me crazy. I got steroidal rage. I hallucinated. It was difficult for me to act peaceful, to act even balanced. Things that might have been just an impulse in normal times, somebody cuts me off, I'm mad for a fraction of a second. I had to just take 30 seconds to be calm. Living my values was like walking. Normally, I don't think about walking, and you don't think about it. We walk. We just go ahead. These moments of balance and not being balanced. But when I was on these steroids, being sane, acting sane, was like walking with no balance, where each footstep was intentional and trembling and unsure. I was acting saner and more peaceful than I felt. Authenticity is overrated. I am willing to be a phony, peaceful person if it keeps me peaceful. I'm willing to act like a better man than I think I am in order to have the kind of life that I want. This is the social contract. This is we give up some of our selfishness, some of our self-indulgence, some of our impulsivity in order to connect. Because the price, it's a price worth paying for being together in community, in family, even just with ourselves. I believe that peace starts here. I believe that we can, not perfectly, but often, choose peace and act, even if it is an act, peacefully. That we can be peaceful from heartbeat to heartbeat in our own hearts, in our own families, in our own communities. And someday, I pray, in my own car. Would you join in supporting this wonderful organization as we try to give life and peace and community a chance together?